Our next case is 13-1794, Crystal Wilkins versus Shaste Incorporated et al. We only have the appellant present, Mr. Polis.
Good morning, Your Honors, Chief Justice O'Connor, and may it please the court. Crystal Wilkins asks the court today to bring Ohio into line with the overwhelming majority of jurisdictions that permit litigants to invoke attorney fee provisions in rules and statutes, regardless of the party's representation agreement with her lawyer. Any other result will foster unfair distinctions based upon whether and how a party pays her counsel. The rule at issue in this case, Civil Rule 37A4, for example, is designed to ensure fair play. There is no reason that the remedy under that rule should be available to some litigants and not to all. We're in an unusual circumstance today because every single constituent that has weighed in on this matter before this court agrees that this court should reverse the 8th District's decision and reinstate Ms. Wilkins' attorney fee award. No one, not even Ms. Wilkins' opponent, advocates a different result. And all four judges below, the trial judge who awarded the $1,000 attorney fee sanction, and all three judges of the 8th District agreed that that should be the result. But two of those judges in the 8th District reluctantly reversed the award because of one sentence from paragraph 24 of this court's 2007 decision in the Register case. Ms. Wilkins asks the court today to correct that one sentence in Register and to confirm that an attorney's fee arrangement with counsel, with the client, is not dispositive of the right to recover attorney fees under rules and statutes that have fee shifting provisions, and in particular under Civil Rule 37A4.
Well, your client has not paid any attorney fees. Am I right or wrong?
That's correct, Justice O'Donnell.
Okay. And if we determine that as a discovery sanction, $1,000 of attorney fees should be awarded to your client, do you expect that you are entitled to that $1,000?
Yes, Your Honor.
Or is your client entitled to that money?
Under the law, the right to recover attorney fees when the law provides for them is a right that belongs to the client.
But and if, so the money goes to your client, not to you.
In the first
counsel.
Instance, but at page 65 of the supplement, the court will see our agreement with Ms. Wilkins that requires her to cooperate with us in securing fee awards when the law provides for them, and the nature of that agreement is that our clinic at Case Western Reserve University will be the ultimate recipient of that award. And in fact,
go ahead.
If we have so many jurisdictions that have weighed in on this question, and the legal aid societies that filed an amicus brief pointed the court to two jurisdictions, Hawaii and North Carolina, that ostensibly come out the other way. But in fact, if the court looks at the Hawaii case cited in that amicus brief, the court will see that what the Hawaii Supreme Court actually said is that we do not want a windfall to a client who has no payment obligation, but that in fact, we assume that the client will be obligated to pay the legal services organization that represented her in that case, and we therefore sustain the award.
So your agreement with her, pursuant to, I guess, a boilerplate agreement that you use with all clients?
Well, we do alter the agreement depending on the nature of the representation, but the phrase in question, the passage in question is standard for us.
On page 65 is standard that we're not going to charge you anything, but in the event that there are attorney fees awarded statutorily or under rule, you get to collect those.
That's exactly right, Your Honor.
Okay, so there is, I mean, my understanding of it's the Eighth District's ruling here, they don't even pay attention to that.
Justice Stewart, in her dissenting opinion, did mention that and used that as a basis for drawing a distinction from register.
But the majority does not hang their hat on that or acknowledge that they don't treat it as, or distinguish it in any way.
Correct. The majority also did not address our argument below that the Sophia Ward was not opposed in the first instance by process to closing at the trial court level.
Counsel, that's something that did catch my attention at this level.
You didn't introduce yourself by name. I presume you're the professor.
Andrew Paulus, Your Honor.
I notice you have some very interesting colleagues here today in the sense that all of the major law firms in Cleveland have filed an amicus on your behalf. And they represent, in my opinion, those who would be paying these fees, do they not?
The law firms themselves?
Well, no, their clients. Baker and Hostetler, for example, would be the people who would be sued by your clinic. And why are they therefore supporting where you are today?
Well, the entire, almost every constituent from the bar, members of the bar from the state of Ohio, ranging from private lawyers to the Ohio Attorney General, supports our position. And the private law firms, as I understand it, submitted an amicus brief because they are interested in opportunities to perform pro bono services, as this court has admonished all of us to do. And when they serve that pro bono function, they want to be able to recover attorney fees under Rule 37A4, the same as their adversaries.
There's not a contradiction in terms there? I want to work for free, but I'd like to be paid for it?
It's not a question of so much wanting to be paid for it as it is wanting to be able to represent clients on an equal footing. If we do not have reciprocity here, if Rule 37A4 is not a rule that applies equally to both plaintiff and defendant regardless of fee agreement, the incentives that will create for parties to abuse the discovery system and to know that they can get away with it, and that the only thing that they risk is perhaps losing a motion to compel, but no greater sanction than that. The incentive there is great to abuse the discovery system, which is this.
Well, counsel, I don't want to make light of this, but this is a very big policy question here. And I guess what you're advocating here and these amicus are advocating is, yes, we would like to do pro bono work because it's a good idea for our profession. Everybody likes that idea. But also we'd like to be paid for it. Isn't that really what's being said here?
Your Honor, I would submit that when an attorney undertakes to perform pro bono work, the remote possibility of recovering an attorney fee sanction under a discovery rule, if it even happens, reflects such a small percentage of the time that an attorney spends in performing pro bono services, that it really isn't about wanting to be paid for pro bono work. It's simply wanting to be able to perform that pro bono work without being under the weight of a disparity in the system that permits parties who don't have to pay for attorney fee sanctions when they abuse the discovery rules to
counsel,
get away with it.
Counsel, I don't see this as having to be a major shift in our rule or an interpretation of our rule. I think your page 65 of your fee agreement, as Judge Stewart classifies it, characterizes it, allows us to do this without, you know, usually rules, we're not going to, you know, tamper with rules or make policy changes with rules until it goes back to the Rules Committee, the people that we appoint who are experts, and you've been on commissions and committees here, so you know what the process is. But we, as the seven members, are not going to dictate a rule change from the bench in the normal course of how we do things. But I don't see us having to go there for this. I think your agreement allows for what you're asking.
Well, Your Honor, obviously we would be satisfied with that result in this case. To be candid, there is language in register that says that the client must actually incur the obligation to counsel. The exact language is, like an award of attorney fees under revised code 149.43, which is the public records statute, mm-hmm. An award of attorney fees as a sanction for a discovery violation must actually be incurred by the party seeking the award. That's the language that led the majority in the 8th District to reluctantly hold.
I understand that, but I think that Judge Stewart's analysis will get us where you want to be if we adopt it as a majority here.
And we would obviously be satisfied with that result.
Although, counsel, looking at Rule 37, and just we don't have the opposing side, any opposing side here, looking at Rule 37, we talk about a sanction of attorney fees. And that, to me, suggests, I mean, another way of looking at this is that attorney's fees must exist for the sanction then to be imposed. And your fee agreement, if we don't have the actual language in Judge Stewart's dissent, she says it requires assistance and cooperation with efforts to obtain attorney's fees from adverse parties. But there's no obligation for this client to pay. I mean, she's not saddled with attorney's fees, so she doesn't have that problem. And the sanction is to remedy the problem of having to pay attorney fees. So what you're saying here is that the sanction of attorney fees shouldn't be limited to whether the client has to pay them.
That's absolutely what we've argued, Justice Lenziger. And in fact, the term attorney fees is, as the 10th Circuit held in the Centennial case, a term of art. The 10th Circuit picked that up from the Supreme Court, where in the Blum versus Stenson and the Blanchard versus Bergeron cases, the Supreme Court held that under 42 U.S.C. section 1988, the phrase attorney fees refers to the value of the attorney's services, not necessarily what the client is obligated
to pay.
So
that seems to be the way, another way to kind of clarify this, rather than talking about, as Register might suggest, the obligation of a client to pay a bill to an attorney, you're suggesting the sanction could be the value of the attorney's services is the sanction that we're going to allow.
Yes, Your Honor, that's absolutely what we have argued. And in fact, it's particularly appropriate. Your Honor has used the word sanction. That is the phrase that is used in describing these remedies under Rule 37. And sanctions, as the court knows, are punitive, not compensatory.
Counsel, then would it make any difference what your agreement would be with the client? I mean, if we looked at it that way, it wouldn't matter if an individual is if there's a discovery problem in a pro se case, let's say, or a case where there is pro bono client, and that individual, the court finds in favor of that individual on a discovery dispute, it doesn't matter. The attorney fees could be awarded without respect to what the agreement said, because that's, we're talking value of the services rendered.
Absolutely, Your Honor. And in fact, in the Register case, I think part of what the confusion may have arisen is that the public record statute that I referred to in quoting from Register is a very specific statute that contains a provision that says that a fee award under that statute is remedial and not punitive. That's a quote from it.
What was the evidence offered before Judge First as to arriving at the $1,000 sanction that the court entered in this case?
Your Honor, I placed an affidavit in front of Judge First that appears in the supplement and that estimates.
Don't we require evidence of a reasonable hourly rate and the time spent in order to calculate the amount of attorney fees to be awarded?
Yes, Your Honor, and that is in this case.
Don't we require experts to testify as to that?
It doesn't require an expert except to the extent that the court can find that the attorney of record in the case has that expert function. If the foundation is laying that attorney is familiar with the prevailing hourly rates in the community.
We don't normally award attorney fees with affidavits. We require experts to come and testify to the reasonable value of the services and someone to testify as to the time that's been spent. This arises out of one motion, am I right?
Yes, Your Honor. The practice in discovery.
Is there any evidence of how long it took to prepare the motion?
Yes, Your Honor. If I direct your attention to our motion to compel, in which my affidavit at page 32 of the supplement lays out the hours expended and...
On preparing the motion to compel?
Yes, exactly on that.
And was not opposed?
It was not opposed.
Your attorney fees, so there was no opposition, and you laid out what you, the time and the value, correct?
Yes, Your Honor. In fact, I think the relevant paragraphs from that affidavit are quoted verbatim in our brief.
Okay. The one thing that Justice Lansinger brought up, and she said either someone proceeding pro se or represented by a pro bono. A pro se litigant is a different character here. They're not going to be able to show value received and commensurate with the work of an attorney. So we're not talking about pro se. We're only talking about litigants who are represented by clinics such as yours or other forms of pro bono representation.
Your Honor, I see my time has expired. May I answer your question? No, I don't think the court needs to go so far in this case as to address the question in the context of pro bono parties. I'm sorry, pro se parties. There's a much more complicated policy concern where pro se parties are at issue because we don't really want to encourage parties not to hire lawyers. And there's a U.S. Supreme Court case that talks about that in the 1988
context. And
there's
no award then to pro se for attorney fees.
We are not advocating that here, and I don't think the court needs to arrive at that issue.
I agree. Your brief talks about Gladys. Are you saying that register has to be overruled?
Your Honor, the issue really is the one that came up in my colloquy with Chief Justice O'Connor about whether it can be distinguished on the basis of our fee agreement or whether the language of register is so sweeping that, in fact, even under the fee agreement that we had, we would not qualify. So that really depends on how one reads that language. In candor, I'm a little troubled by the language of register, even with our fee agreement, but obviously we would be satisfied with the rule that would distinguish register in that way.
If we didn't look at your fee agreement and talked about looking at sanction under 37D, would we have to overrule register?
37D uses caused by language. 37A4 uses incurred, and I'm not sure there's a meaningful distinction to be made between those phrases. So, I think whatever result the court arrives at on the basis of looking at our retainer agreement and concluding whether or not register does or does not create a problem for us, it would be the same under both 37A4 and 37B and D.
Counsel, I do have one practical question for here. Are we setting up a system where we might have a difference in value between, let's say, pro bono work provided by a law firm that might charge very high rates typically, or and as between that and maybe a legal aid organization or even a government agency for their lawyers? Do we need to address that kind of a concern if we're talking about value?
The short answer to your question, Your Honor, is no, you don't need to address it. And this gets back in part to Justice O'Donnell's question about what the evidence is that supports the calculation of the fee award. I would certainly argue that there's no basis for concluding as a general rule that lawyers who work in private law firms provide more valuable services than those who work in legal services organizations. In this case, in fact, the hourly rate that I put in my affidavit for the 1 hour of time I spent on this was half of what my hourly rate was
What is the evidence in the case as to what the hourly rate is?
The hourly rate that I used for the 1 hour of my time, Your Honor, was $200. Which is about half of what it was when I left private practice. And for the legal interns who expended 8 hours together on this motion, the evidence was $100 an hour was reasonable for, given that they were about to be law graduates, third year law students.
But couldn't there also be, for example, if you were in a government agency and you were providing work just as a matter of your regular duties, couldn't you also use a multiplier, for example, an hourly rate plus whatever your benefit cost might be?
There are.
And haven't we done that in the past?
Yes, Your Honor. Well, I don't know if this court has. Certainly
the court has.
The Supreme Court, yes, has. The U.S. Supreme Court has done that. The lodestar method, which is number of hours times reasonable hourly rate, is the standard for an attorney fee award, but it is not, it's a presumptive standard. It is not the absolute standard. And in every case, the actual value of the services will be a factual matter, as Justice O'Donnell alluded to. I do think it can be provided by affidavit, however, and especially when there's no opposition, we don't want to require trial judges to have evidentiary hearings every time there's a fee dispute in a discovery context.
Thank you.
Thank you, Your Honor. We ask that you reverse the 8th District and reinstate Ms. Wilkins' fee award.
We'll take the matter under advisement. Marsha, will you call a recess?